Brian. Welcome to Dad's on the Air for July the 8th, 2008. Well, we've got an interesting show coming up. We've got Barbara Kay. She's a journalist with the National Post in Canada. Has written quite extensively on fathers' issues and domestic violence. The National Post in Canberra has a long history of writing quite courageous pieces that really go against the general tide of mainstream debate. And really terrific. That should be a really interesting interview. We've also got Marlia Blong, also from America. She's an expert on boys' education. That should be an interesting interview as well. Don't forget, you can listen to this show via live streaming at the 2GLF website, and welcome to those who are joining us from around the world via that live streaming. And also don't forget, you can listen to us at www.dadsontheair.net. The website has been down this morning, but it's back up and running. If you've been trying to get on, that's dadsontheair.net. And the show should be up there within 24 hours or so. We also have in the studio with us Ian Purdy.
Good morning, everybody.
Philip York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, everyone.
Greg Anderson.
Good morning.
And a special treat, Kylie Innocente.
Good morning.
So she's visiting us from London, so and very welcome. And my name is John Stapleton, so thank you. We're just going to look at a few different news items to start off with. The controversy over the 2020 summit continues to escalate. We mentioned this last week that astonishingly very few, read no, fathers' representatives from any of the mainstream groups have been invited to the summit, and there was a particular section there called Families, Communities and Social Inclusion, which was, one would have thought, the absolutely appropriate place to get fathers' voices in there. They haven't done so. There's a number of staunch feminist advocates, including Kathleen Swinburne from the Assault Parents Union. Not a single bloke. And this is under a topic heading which has the nerve of calling itself social inclusion. During the week, the Australian 2020 summit's papers have come out, so that the Strengthening Communities, Supporting Families and Social Inclusion section, very, very cleverly, I must say, manages to raise all these topics and not once mention the word fathers. Quite astonishing. We've got Australia's population is ageing, and we'll all be over 65 sooner or later. A high migrant population and a wealth of cultures, you know, the usual multicultural propaganda that we're so used to over the last few decades. High cultural diversity is a phenomenon of inner urban communities. That's another subject of debate. Between 5 and 35% of people arrived in Australia less than 5 years ago. No one seems to note that that causes a lot of social difficulties. The high rate of immigration in Australia has always been against the general support of the community, but on it goes, for better or for worse some days. For most people, family remains the anchor point of support. Networks and social engagement is another section. Family is the most common form of support for people in crisis and also the greatest beneficiary of our generosity and care. And they look at where people seek support. Family comes top, friends next, neighbours next, workmates next. Other, of course, way down the bottom, and where all the money goes. Driving them where all your time goes, driving them places, paying bills, lending car, money for housing. It's amazing how you can cover so many topics but not mention the word dads. Increasingly, families come in a wide range of forms, so we'll have a whole lot of kerfuffle about the diversity of the modern family type, and we're all very diverse in here, I can tell you now. But, you know, there are dads out there. There's more than a million separated dads in Australia, and they rarely ever get a mention. It's quite amazing that you can put out a paper. Here's just one more. Women are increasingly highly educated, having fewer children, and are participating more fully in the workforce. Discuss. Huh. How about we discuss a few dads' issues? Quite amazing, and I think the fathers' groups are going to be calling for a separate summit to rectify the absolute failure to mention fathers whatsoever. And there's a lot of fair movement going on, particularly from the Fatherhood Foundation over that. we'll just take another look at a few other issues. First off, there's a major kerfuffle in one of the high schools.
Yes, in the Daily Telegraph this morning, the headline was "Not in our schools." And under this headline, Cara Lawrence and David Barrett have written, rather sensationally, I might point out, "Glorification of American gang violence may be behind a horrific schoolyard attack involving five boys as young as 14 armed with machetes and baseball bats. Students of Maryland High School yesterday blamed the emergence of young self-styled suburban gangs in Sydney's West for the attack." And what basically happened was a bunch of kids charged into a school assembly and started smashing the place up, breaking windows, and one of the teachers was assaulted. The police were called. They did surrender without putting up too much resistance, basically laid their weapons down. I think one of the boys tried to run away, but the police managed to grab him and handcuff him. But I mean, this really is pretty ridiculous stuff. I mean, the fact that these young guys have got the gall and the nerve to go into a school and attack the place and wreak havoc with baseball bats, and I mean, it boggles the brain, really. Where is our society going that young people think that this is acceptable behaviour? They think they're going to get some sort of kudos from this. You know, I guess they've got lots of media coverage.
Obvious question, where was Dad?
Well, that's is the obvious question. Where was their dad? If their dad was at home waiting with his belt for when they got home, I think it would have had a bit of a different outcome.
Yes, and also there's a lot of discussion over women and part-time work, which is an interesting story.
Well, there is indeed. Yes, this appeared in this morning's Australian. Chris Merritt, under the headline, "Part-timers fail at work and at home." And she, or he or she, writes... He, Chris Merritt, is a he, I have it on good authority. He writes, "Part-time employment has failed to deliver either at home or in the office, with large numbers of white-collar workers suffering career burnout and family stress. Those hit hardest are women professionals who had looked to part-time work as a way of balancing family responsibilities and a working life. But a report to be published today says many part-time professionals are being confronted with reduced income, career dead ends, and the inability to find enough family time." So really, you've got to say from this that the mad feminist thrust led by idiots like Germaine Greer that took place in the 60s to reinvent our society has basically not only failed men, which we talk about every week on this program, but it's also failed women.
Interesting. There's an astonishing number of stories come out this week about the absolutely appalling levels of literacy amongst Indigenous children, and we've looked quite closely over a number of programs at the intervention and what's going on in these communities, and we'll continue to take a close look at that phenomenon on this program. Listen to this.
This is an article by Helen Hughes in the Opinion in the Australian. She writes, "The Northern Territory Department of Education reported in 2006-07 that reading and numeracy year 3, 5 and 7 benchmark passes for remote Indigenous students averaged less than half those for non-Indigenous students. For 2004-05, the last year that figures for remote Indigenous children were published, the average passes for remote Indigenous children were 20% compared with 90% for non-Indigenous children." It's an interesting article that goes on to talk about that the reason for the poor results in numeracy and literacy are due to under-resourcing of these schools, that they don't have contemporary teaching aids. But more than that, the actual teaching methods are actually not up to speed.
It's also amazing that if you don't send your kid to school in the this suburb or any other suburb in Sydney, you have the authorities around in 5 seconds flat. A lot of these kids are just not going to school. They're not learning anything, ever. They just don't see education as part of their life.
And a lot of them are going to school and are still not learning anything, especially boys. My son is an example. He goes to school every day faithfully. We pack his lunch and send him off, and he just seems to think it's a social club. The teachers haven't engaged him. He hasn't can't read, can't write, can't do anything. Year three, we're going to have to start teaching them ourselves, apparently, the teachers tell us. We're going to have to start...
We'll have a boys' education expert on later in the program. It's a really vital issue for a lot of parents. And we'll end the news section on a lighter, I think, note.
Yeah, good on you, John. Thanks for that. Yeah, we've already spoken about diverse families this morning, and I guess these two stories go from the bizarre and onto the ridiculous. The first one is written up from Canberra in April 6th. It says, a South Australian woman has given birth to her father's son after the couple had sex. John and Jenny Devis reunited 30 years after Mr. Devis separated from Jenny's mother. We are just asking for a little bit of respect and understanding. Their 9-month-old daughter, Celeste, shown on TV, appears fit and healthy. I was looking at him sort of going, oh, he's not too bad. Like, seriously, you would. You know, this is her father she's talking about. And she goes on to say, like you would look at a man across a bar at a nightclub. Mr. Devis admitted that he initially thought having sex with his daughter was wrong. A duh.
Good old Mr. Devis, eh?
Yeah, good on him. You know,
good thought there in the beginning, but he obviously discarded that one pretty quickly.
A really perceptive bloke, eh?
Yeah, absolutely, mate.
And quite amazing.
Yes, and then he goes on to say that his emotions took over. As people no doubt realise, there are times during your life when emotions do rule. Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Devis, but no, I just couldn't go there, and I don't see how you could either.
I don't know. I thought that we were sort of biologically programmed not to, basically. That, you know, there is a sort of whole instinctual thing that sleep with your offspring.
I know
it happens and all that, but...
Yeah. Especially having children, but they'd had one child before, apparently, that was born with some kind of heart defect, and it died after a couple of days, but that didn't deter them.
Oh, so this is their second...
This is their second child. Oh. Celeste is their second child. That's... She's got to 11 months, so...
Yeah,
well, the whole genetic thing about, you know, combining the genes from the same family, you know, we all did high school biology, and it's not a smart way to procreate, shall we say.
Absolutely not. And funnily enough, the South Australian Police media spokesman said that the couple were being monitored.
The couple, I like that.
Yeah, they're apparently allowed to live together, but they're not allowed to have sex.
Oh, good.
So I don't know what that monitoring entails, but hey, yes, I'd like to see that job description. And then we go on to the United States in the Courier Mail, written by Michael Conlon in Chicago, where a transgender man who is 6 months pregnant said in an interview aired by Oprah Winfrey during the week that he has always wanted to have a child and considers it a miracle.
So what was his transgender? Did he start off as a woman? He started off as a man? I mean...
No, he started off as a woman.
Right, and then he became a man.
Yeah,
she became a man.
We'll be back in a moment. We'll be talking with Barbara Kay. She's a reporter from the National Post in Canada. We'll be back.
You are a friend. Then if you're tall and handsome and sexes and there'll be no people left. And so it goes, go round again. But now and then we wonder who the real men are. Whoa, oh, whoa, 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 whoa.
And welcome back to Dad's on the Air. On the line from Ontario, Canada, we have Barbara Kay. And Barbara is a columnist with the National Post newspaper in Canada. And Barbara, it's a great pleasure to have you on Dad's on the Air this morning.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, Greg. One correction, I'm from Quebec, actually.
Quebecois.
Yes, that's me.
Fantastic. But the newspaper is published out of Ontario, is that right?
That's right. I just sit in my study in Montreal and I email in my columns. And
Fantastic. Well, it's a great pleasure to have you on Dad's on the Air. And I believe this is your first Australian interview, so we're really honoured.
Well, I'm very, very pleased and very honoured to have been chosen.
Fantastic. Now, Barbara, you've got a bit of a reputation amongst the men's and fathers movement around the world for being a very courageous author and writing a whole series of very male and father positive articles in the National Post. Your articles have been circulated quite widely around the globe, and we'd really like to have a chat with you about some of the things that you've written about. You've actually, very recently on the 4th of April, actually there was a speech of yours that has appeared in print on the web called Who's Oppressing Who? And I believe that was a speech that you made at the McGill University Women's Alumni Association.
Yes, I was asked to speak. I was very pleased to be asked to speak. As it turned out, the program committee, the person who had sort of put my name forward, is somebody who is on my wavelength. And at the very last minute, there was a bit of a controversy because some people, I think some women from the Women's Studies Department, when they got wind of it, they sort of did a little campaign to try to get me disinvited.
So much for free speech, eh?
Well, I just that sort of thing gets me quite angry. So I told the program, and they were ready to cave in. This is the interesting thing, how cowardly and how people can't stand controversy of any kind at the university. You know, there's just no diversity of opinion allowed. So they were ready to cancel, and I said, well, look here, you know, you can let me say what I have to say about feminism to 40 people in the audience, or you can let me say it in a column to 400,000 people, because if you disinvite me, that'll be the subject of my next column. So they let me speak.
Fantastic. And what was the reception you got there?
I actually got quite a good reception. You know, they had actually hired a security guard, which just amused me. I said, well, I've really arrived now. I have my own security guard when I talk. But it wasn't necessary. The women were respectful. It was mostly women, some men. Afterwards, I was very pleased that there were a good number of young women. And they came up after, and they said, you've really made us think. We've never heard these things before. And I said, well, you should be hearing some of these things, because I'm just speaking from evidence. I'm not speaking, you know, just out of anger or because I like guys or something like that. This is a very unfair, a lot of unfairness and injustice here, and nobody talks to you about this. This is unfortunate.
I might just quote a little bit from your speech. You wrote, you spoke, I'm the daughter, one of three, of a charismatic, entrepreneurial, risk-taking father. Having known the privations of extreme poverty in his youth, he was so obsessed with providing economic security for his family that he literally worked himself to a premature death. Because he was a hero to me, I am well disposed toward the men I meet, unless I am shown good reason not to be, and as a result, there are many wonderful men in my life. Obviously, your relationship with your father has provided a real background for your compassion for men and fathers. Do you want to talk a little bit about your relationship with him?
Yes, my father was a wonderful man, very charismatic, very beloved in our community. He had a great heart. He was a philanthropist. He never said no to a cause. He had a marvelous sense of humor. He was a gorgeous man. He was looked like Clark Gable. He was a wonderful dancer, and he used to dance with us, at weddings and parties, and we felt so delighted, to be whisked around the floor by him. He was a very manly man, very loving to his daughters, and we felt, I came to the conclusion when he died too young, and I realized that my own success in life, both my sisters' success, it is because we had a strong father who believed in us, who was very proud of our academic success, who boasted about us to his friends. I never felt that not being a guy. This was before feminism, and we were encouraged to realize our potential. And I've come to the conclusion when I look around at the women I know who are successful, most of them, it's not that they have loving mothers, because loving mothers, I'm not discounting the value of a loving mother, but women need a strong and a loving father if they're going to negotiate their way in the world with success and to have confidence in themselves. I think it's a tremendous shame how many daughters, well, I think sons too, I guess, but I'm a woman. So, this is my relationship with men is founded on my respect for my father, my sense that he was special, and he's, special to other people too. So he was a huge influence on me.
Now, you're also Jewish, and you write in that same speech that because of your people's unique history, you're instinctively wary of any group, whether it's a race or an ethnic group or a sex, that is scapegoated, basically, to explain the unachieved goals of its own members. Do you really think that the sort of misandry against men has reached the sort of level of hatred that was around against and has been around towards Jews throughout history?
I would not say that it is a that virulent a hatred. What I would say, though, is that feminism, what has happened to the feminists, not ordinary women, but the people who are running the institutions or the women's studies courses, the women who are stakeholders in the feminist movement, are acting on a conspiracy theory of history. This is what this is why I use the Jewish example, because hatred of Jews is always founded on a conspiracy theory, that the Jews are sitting somewhere in a little room plotting to take over the world,
right.
They're running all the banks and all that sort of thing. Well, in its own way, feminism is a conspiracy theory, because the theory is that this patriarchal group, that men somehow all sit together in a room and say, well, now, how can we control women? How can we get them to do our bidding, to be our sexual slaves, to, just stay out of our way while we have our... It's bizarre. Before the reform movement that feminism started out as, in a good way, yes, of course, all these reforms were necessary. Women had to have equal opportunities, equal economic opportunities. Yes, that was all necessary. But the patriarchy that they were rebelling against was not an organized movement against women. It was the way society was. And societies can change and grow, and cultures can get new insights and change. And that's precisely what happened. And it's why men did not fight back, because they saw the logic of how society had to change. They went along with it because it was logical and, yeah, it was the right thing to do. There was never, people talk about the gender wars. Well, there was no war. It was one side deciding that there was an enemy, and the so-called enemy was very bewildered because there never had been an organized campaign against women. It was, yes, of course, there was a patriarchy, but that was an organic kind of happening. It wasn't something that came about because of hatred of women. it was the way society was.
And it was actually the way that human beings have survived. I mean, pre-birth control, when a woman had sex, she pretty much was guaranteed to become pregnant, and women raised, you know, very, very large families. Yeah. Father to be the provider and be out there in the world and leave her being at home to look after the kids, that was the only way that human beings could survive.
Yes, and all cultures, you can't apply the standards of today's, our rules and standards. You can't retroactively go back 100 years and say, you see, men were terrible then. They were oppressive. You can't do that because in the time that they lived, they didn't consider it oppressive, and neither did most of the women. You're quite right that when you're living in a society where women are very dependent on the strength and the protection of men, it goes along with a certain amount of patriarchy. That's the way it was.
Absolutely. We might just ask you one more question before we go to a music track. Obviously, one of the big issues that we talk about here on Dads on the Air is the family law system. And it seems the family law system across the Western world appears to be quite stacked against men and fathers.
It's written brutal.
Absolutely. And often completely secretive, especially in the UK. You've given a few quotes of some of the things that family law professionals in Canada have said. I might read a couple of these out. Supreme Court of Canada's Chief Justice, Beverly McLaughlin, says, "We have to be proactive in rearranging the Canadian family." Former Justice Minister Martin Cochon said, "Men have no rights, only responsibilities." And most egregiously, from the National Association of Women and the Law, "Courts may treat parents unequally and deny them basic civil liberties and rights as long as their motives are good." Do you think that are these typical of the attitude and the culture of the family law system in Canada?
Oh, yes, absolutely. 90% of contested child custody cases end up with sole custody given to the woman. That's just a ridiculous statistic. It shouldn't happen in any branch of law, because if something goes to appeal, then it goes because there's a balance of, the case should be able to come out either way. If it's coming out 90%, one way, there's prejudice in the system, and there is prejudice in the system because these judges are they're trained. The National Judicial Institute trains judges, and they are trained by feminist psychologists who are handpicked because of their ideology to do the training. It goes all the way down. May I tell you one anecdote that will take just 1 minute?
Absolutely.
I know one of the women sitting on the Supreme Court of Canada is a personal friend of mine, and she's a wonderful woman in every respect, except she's kind of has a blind spot in her ardent feminism. And we were chatting once, and she says, "You know, why do you keep writing all these things about domestic violence being equal between men and women?" I said, "Because it is." And she says, "But that's just ridiculous." She said, "The statistics are that 95% of domestic violence is men against women." I said, "My dear, you're quoting a police statistic. You're not quoting the violence statistic. What you're quoting is the arrest statistic. And the only reason the arrest statistic is that way is because police are told that they must arrest the man when they come into a domestic dispute, and they're not allowed to ask who started it, and they don't care." Now, I thought to myself, if a judge on the Supreme Court of Canada is unaware of the actual statistics around domestic violence, isn't that a really sad commentary?
Of course, Canada has been an absolute leader in this, and it's been adopted. Much of what happens in Canada has been adopted right around the Western world. Is there much of a backlash in Canada itself?
there's no backlash whatsoever. It's people say, oh, it's wonderful you write these columns, and I can tell you that they fall into a black hole. They have no influence, and the only people that read them are men who are in that situation. I don't think they've made a dent at all, and the situation gets worse because the people that are going into family law are highly ideological, mostly women, with an agenda. I see awareness amongst politicians, and I do see that now that we have a conservative government, there's a great deal of sympathy amongst politicians, but we're in a minority government, and they will not, this is one area, they will not tread on women's, you know, perceived rights, because they know that that is a vote loser.
We're talking with Barbara Kay. She's a columnist with the National Post in Canada and a great leader in the gender debate around the world. We'll be back in a moment.
I fought her. And I fought her. We were like two lambs at the slaughter. Neither the earth nor the wind nor the flame could tame her. Under the water was the place with Neptune's daughter. Under the water I sought her. Light from the surface, the sea ablaze with rays. Deeper and deeper, but I could not see her. Then all at once she appeared. Now I'm under the water with Neptune's daughter. Neptune's daughter, lost in the currents that moved around, 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 around me. Somehow she found me. I'm under the water, Neptune's daughter. We don't need air, we got everything here. The fish and the sea, they're enough for me. I'm under the water with Neptune's daughter.
To Dad's on the Air. On the line from Quebec in Canada, we have Barbara Kay, columnist with the National Post newspaper. Barbara, you've written in one of your articles that, once again on the topic of family law, most men think such Kafkaesque scenarios can't happen to them. We're obviously talking about, you know, a divorce situation where they trot along to the family court and expect a fair hearing. You write, happily married men, parenting with equal diligence, believe in their hearts that men who find themselves savaged by the family law system are congenital losers or were demonstrably lousy husbands and fathers. Many such winners are in for an unpleasant surprise. Do you think that one of the reasons that the family law system has continued to exist for so long with so little change is that so many men who haven't experienced the brutality of the system really are unaware and ignorant and believe it couldn't happen to them?
I do believe that. Just the men that I speak to casually, men that I know that are happily married, they are very skeptical about. I say to them, you know, I get letters, I get email that break my heart. I can't. It's a very emotional thing for me because men send me stories and they're candid. They pour out the facts of their case. I'm quite helpless to do anything about it, but I can listen at least, and I keep their stories. I have a file, and I say these are terrible stories. They're tragic. And they're skeptical. They say, oh, come on. They say, look, these guys, if these women are doing this to these guys, then they must be weak or they don't get it or they made lousy choices. And in other words, they're skeptical that this couldn't just happen to a perfectly normal guy out of the blue. And they're not buying it because they're happy at the moment, you know. And I say, but it does happen. And they get, because the women don't start out being, they're not awful people to start out with, but they're encouraged by the system to exploit loopholes and privileges that only they have. They're encouraged in social services to find something they can say that the guy's abusive or, you know, to stop in at a women's shelter because once you've been to a women's shelter, that goes on your record, and sure enough. So, you know, the whole system encourages women. It brings out the worst in the woman.
Sure, and you can't really blame the women because, I mean, the custody of their children is at stake, and sure, it does bring the worst in them out, but it's the system that's at fault. It's not necessarily...
The system is at fault, and the women are possibly ignorant, but I do blame the women because, really, any woman who thinks that her kid is better off, unless the guy is abusive, but I'm talking about people that are normal. A woman should, if she has her kid's best interest at heart, should really want the father to be as present as possible in the child's life. It just makes sense. And I think this kind of vindictiveness that creeps in, that part is encouraged by the system. It's an adversarial system, and it shouldn't be if the kid's, you know, best interests were really at heart.
Oh, well, really, it's the lawyer's best interest because they make more money the bigger the fight.
It is incredible, isn't it, how little men support each other and how separated men going through a rough time are just ridiculed by people who should be friends and supporters.
Indeed, and that is the great advantage of women, is that women do cluster round, women do support each other, they're used to talking things out, they have no problem admitting when they're hurt, and in our culture, you know, victimization is encouraged, or a feeling of grievance, and so that they fit right into the whole general culture, don't they? Whereas men are socialized to suck it up and to be a man and not to complain and not to seek support because it's seen as a weakness. So, yeah, I would say men don't ask for help easily, and men don't give help. It doesn't come naturally in either case, and that is the great drawback of the men that I can see of the men's rights movement, is this inability to coordinate easily, to organize into groups that are effective, political action groups that are effective. Women, it seems to come very natural to them, and of course they're supported by the system, you know, they're supported financially and whatnot. So that is I guess men are, in a sense, their own worst enemy sometimes.
Do you think also, though, one of the problems, and this is, applies to women equally with men, is that a lot of people see the gender debate or the battle of the sexes, whatever you want to call it, as a zero-sum game, and you've written about this, saying if your sex wins, mine loses, and a lot of guys think, well, these men's rights guys, you know, because they're about supporting men, they must be somehow anti-women, and there's a deep biological almost imperative in all men to protect and love and honour women, and if they see women, perceive women as being somehow attacked because they see this as a zero-sum game, that this may be behind their indifference or even hostility to men who are involved in men's and fathers' rights?
Well, I think that our culture, I think that feminism does inspire that kind of thinking because, as I said before, it is a conspiracy theory. And all conspiracy theories believe that if one side wins, the other side has to lose or vice versa. And that's why it is deeply, deeply corrosive to relationships between the sexes because, you know, obviously the ideal is complementarity and collaboration. And this zero-sum view, it absolutely erodes any idea of cooperation. So you really have to rise above that ideology. And it's imprinted in the system, in our adversarial system. It's terrible and... It privileges women because it sees women as victims needing additional supports. So it does not punish women for their failures, although it punishes men for theirs. Men really are behind the eight ball.
Look, Barbara, one of your predecessors at the National Post was Donna Laframboise. I'm not sure if I pronounced that right.
Laframboise.
Yes. And she held a very similar position to you, what, about 5 or 6 years ago, in that she was enormously famous in a particular circle and her articles were very widely read and widely distributed and she was regarded as a hero of the day. Purely because she spoke out on the very same issues that you've spoken out on, domestic violence, family law, so on and so forth. What do you think of the... And she just disappeared off the face of the planet, basically. What do you think in general of the media's treatment of men's issues?
Well, they ignore it, basically. I don't see... First of all, the fact that my name is now well-known in men's rights circles is, to me, a very sad thing. A, because... the subject has to be written about, or that I'm driven to write about it, and the only reason I am is because of the unfairness. But it also makes me sad that there should be just one person or a few writing about it. To me, it's an outrage. The unfairness is so blatant, and the lack of a level playing field and the misandry, to me, are so evident that I don't understand why I am the only one at the Post. I understand why men don't write about it, because they're afraid to. The blowback is just terrible. Whenever a man tries to criticize women or feminists, or it's not worth it. It's just not worth it. He just gets, treated so terribly, and so I'm sure... career-wise, it's not a good move.
Oh, no.
But why aren't other women writing about it? I don't get it. There are a few other Canadian writers that will occasionally, take up the topic in a kind of casual way. But this could be a full-time subject for any columnist, and one of the reasons I don't write on it more often is because I was informed by my editors that if you write on any one subject too often, you're considered an obsessive and you're read less, not more. So I try to space my columns.
Yeah, the Irish reporter John Waters wrote quite movingly about the career price that many women and men have paid over the years for speaking out on writing about these issues. Look, we're talking with Barbara Kay. She's a columnist with the National Post in Canada. We'll be back in a moment.
It is time for you to step out of the yourself. Yes, it's time for you to stop all of yourself. Oh, oh.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. On the line from Canada, we have Barbara Kay from the National Post. Barbara, you've written a wonderful article on the White Ribbon Day event, which is held all around the world. It's very strong here in Australia. I might just quote a little bit from your article. The Canadian public never seems to weary of the annual December 6th tribute to the 1989 Montreal Polytechnique shooting massacre of 14 women. Indeed, the branding power burgeons with every anniversary. The theme of violence against women dominates the media. New physical memorials are constructed, etc., etc. Their cumulative effect is to link all Canadian men to a global conspiracy against women of jihadist proportions. Could you explain to the listeners really the key problem you have with the message of White Ribbon Day?
Well, this massacre that happened in my city, Montreal, the murderer, his name was Mark Lapine. He was an extremely disturbed, sociopathic young man who had an irrational hatred of women, and he went into the school and shot up all these women. I mean, it was a horrendous occurrence. But the important thing about it was that it was a one-off. This guy who killed them was not part of a group. He was not part of a conspiracy. He was not part of a movement or a Al-Qaeda or any of this.
Right.
You know, he worked alone. You can't say he worked alone because this was the one big thing that he did. So they take this one incident and they start suddenly saying that this is representative of male violence against women. Well, if it were representative, then how come it never happened before and it never happened since? Where are the copycats? This was such a freak occurrence that it was actually the exception that proves the rule that men are never in their own culture violent against women as a group. If men really were seriously violent against women as a group, well then why is it that during separations and divorce, men commit suicide at six or eight times, you know, the percentage of men, then women's statistics don't change. You know, suicides of women don't change during separation. But men's suicides really escalate at a frightening rate. And so it means they direct the violence when they're despairing or when they're in pain, they direct the violence against themselves. So to call all men potentially violent because of one freak massacre is so insulting to an entire sex.
You also mentioned there was another event in Canada with a woman called Laurie Dan. Would you be able to talk a bit about that?
Oh, that was actually in the United States.
In the U.S., but still, it's a good parallel.
Yeah, Yeah, she murdered, she didn't like boys. She murdered a bunch of boys, but I mean, it was a serial killings, not a massacre. But the point is, you want to find crazy women that have done terrible things to men? You can find them. But these are psychopathic individuals, and you cannot use an individual occurrence as representative of an entire group. We don't, my goodness, try to say that all blacks are violent because the statistics around black crime are higher than white. You'd be crucified. You're not allowed to say things about an entire identity group, about any other identity group, and make a generalization without being called racist, homophobic, all these terrible words. But men are the one identity group against whom you may issue any number of insults and slurs, and simply say, well, all men partake of this serious defect. This is to me scandalous.
It's hate speech, really, isn't it?
Well, it is. I consider it the same as racism, the same as an ethnic slur, the same as homophobia. I don't get it.
Well, it's sexism. It's, you know, sexism against men.
Well, it is sexism. It's terrible sexism. And I remember one young guy wrote me. He was actually a nursing student. You know, how many male nursing students are there? And he said in his nursing class on December 6th, you know, which is the massacre day, the White Ribbon Day, he was told that he had to attend a memorial service. He said he didn't want to attend because he didn't feel responsible in any way, or, you know, and they said, well, if he didn't attend, he would fail his course. He had to, because as a man, it was his duty to. Well, what kind of nonsense is that? Why should he feel responsible? And yet, this is the message that this White Ribbon campaign is conceived as. It's a way of entrenching in boys shame at being male, and entrenching in girls the idea that they are all potential victims.
Sure, you might as well say that all men must take on the guilt of Adolf Hitler because he was a bloke and we're all blokes. Well, so that's how irrational the whole argument is. I mean, there have been a lot of evil people in history, but nobody's going to ascribe that evil to the entire group. It was like saying all Germans Adolf Hitler or whatever, you know.
But the thing is, does it do me any good? I often, you know, I think to myself, what kind of person would I be if I walked around muttering about Germans? Germans are all terrible. They're terrible today just the same way they were like 40 years. I mean, is that good for me as a Jew? No. You get on with life and you don't forget, but you get on with things, and you never ascribe evil to an entire group because of the evils that were done in their name. You just can't. And yet, this is the one group that it is allowed to. You are allowed to ascribe group negative motives to all men, that they are all controlling, all potentially violent to women.
It's a blank slate, really, when it comes to men bashing.
But it's so obvious that men's normal men, healthy men, psychologically healthy men, wish to protect women. And in fact, it's one of that I think you mentioned before. It's one of the big reasons why men don't fight very hard sometimes, because they want to protect their wives from having to go through a court case
Their children.
Well, yeah, they want to protect their children, and it's why they don't leave terrible situations very often, because they want to be there for their children. I think, to me, the most natural impulse in healthy men is protectiveness, and it's a wonderful quality.
And we're talking about, you know, probably 99% of men as well. It's not.
Well, we are. And yet this is entirely discounted, or it's called paternalism. This is extremely unfair. Culture is the arbiter of how men treat women and women treat men. And if you are brought up in a culture that considers women to be inferior beings, well, naturally, you're going to treat them that way. But our culture, our Anglosphere, our, you know, Western culture is not like that. And the men that grow up in our heritage culture, unless they are psychologically damaged in some way, are not violent to women, you know. So It's demonstrable.
Mm. Look, we might move on to just one last question.
Sure.
Before we have to let you go. During the 1980s and 1990s, well, throughout the Western world, but you've written on the Canadian experience, there are a number of studies and revelations on widespread child sexual abuse against boys. There were paedophile rings of lawyers, doctors, police officers and Catholic clergymen that for decades preyed on society's most vulnerable boys. Now,
yeah.
Interestingly, though, in recent years, in 2006, across the Ontario public health system, a screening program was developed called RUCS, Routine Universal Comprehensive Screening, that basically screens all women and girls, I believe, for the signs of sexual abuse, but does not have an equivalent program to screen males.
That's right.
Could you outline a bit of this? I guess it's sexism once again, in
your
opinion.
There was a task force that was convened by the Attorney General of Ontario, and that person is an ardent feminist, and they came up with this protocol that for all girls 12 or over, any time they went into a hospital or any health unit in Ontario, that they would be routinely, even if they went in for a broken arm or whatever they went in for, they would routinely be screened for past sexual abuse or present, and yet not for boys. Now, of course, they don't call them boys and girls. They call them women and men. It's very interesting because they don't want to call 12-year-old boys boys because that makes a kid sound vulnerable, so they call them men and women.
Mm.
But 12-year-olds are not men and women. They are children, and as such, they are supposed to be treated equally. But they're not, and they get away with it.
The bizarreness of this is that when they justify this, then they say, and I quote, "There's little point in screening for a health condition when no referral resources are available to serve the needs of those identified." So they justify this sexism by saying, well, if we screened for boys and we found these sexually abused boys, there's no services to support them anyway.
I think that was the most terribly ironic thing I've ever seen. I mean, it's just unbelievable to me that someone would admit that so boldly and use it as an excuse. When I called up, this protocol is considered a quote best practice by the Registered Nurses Association of Ontario, and there's 137,000 registered nurses. So if this is a best practice, this means 137,000 nurses have signed on to this. And I think to myself, of all these nurses, do none of them have sons, brothers, and nephews? I mean, this means that their own kids going into a hospital would be, treated differently and wouldn't get the same treatment. And what kind of sheep are these women that they would go along with this?
Okay, we'll have to end it there, Barbara. Thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. It's been an honour to have you on to Dads on the Air, and a great pleasure listening to you. We obviously could talk for quite a lot longer. But,
thank you so much for inviting me. It's a great honour for me to be here.
No, thank you so much for coming on to Dads on the Air. That was Barbara Kay. She's a columnist with the National Post in Canada. She's one of the world's leading commentators on gender issues. We'll be back in a moment.
The road is long, with a many a winding tongue that leads us to who knows where. His welfare is my concern.
he ain't heavy. He's my brother. It's a long, long road from which there is no return. While we're on the way to there, why not share?
Barbara Kay from the National Post. What an interesting woman. Really, very interesting. Look, there's an absolutely outrageous story that's been around this week, which we really can't ignore, and that is that Maurice Yemma is urging changes to the law so that parents of kids who truant will be thrown in jail.
Good old Yogi Yemma and the boo-boos and the beer pit. For people who don't know, he's the Premier of New South Wales, which is the state we have all been sentenced to live in.
And why he's running what's widely regarded as an incompetent government.
Absolutely incompetent. Yogi Yemma and the boo-boos in the beer pit. That's really the best summarisation of that crew that
so
we...
So there's been a whole spate of this in, you know, whether your kids are drunk or truanting or whatever, you should be held responsible. On the front page of the Daily Telegraph on Monday, there was a story, parents will be held responsible for drunken teenagers. As figures reveal, 4 children a day, some as young as 10, are being admitted to hospital for alcohol abuse. In a bid to tackle the growing binge drinking epidemic, the Daily Telegraph can reveal parents will be forced to attend counselling with their teenagers or face fines of up to $500.
Well, that's
ridiculous.
By the
time they're teenagers, it's a little bit too late, really. You tried. What were you doing as a teenager? Doing exactly what your parents said? I don't think so. The crackdown by the state government comes at shocking new figures reveal almost 1,700 children had to be treated in hospital for alcohol abuse in the past year. That's a whole other issue. But this followed closely on another story. This is from the Sydney Morning Herald. Education and welfare experts have ridiculed Maurice Yemma's plan to send parents to jail if their children repeatedly miss school, saying the policy is heavy-handed and will only hurt the most disadvantaged students. I'd like to know who's supposed to be looking after the kids while they're in jail. You know, what we send them all off to docs, do we? You know, docs, you know, the great Department of Community Services, which...
Yeah. Well, it's like in the US and Canada, people who fall behind on their child support payments get sent to jail, which that's
which
you know.
That you can't work,
well,
so you can't pay, so
yeah,
you can't fall behind.
How are you going to pay your child support when you're in prison?
Yeah,
I don't know if the prison wage is really that high.
No, really, they should be looking at raising the age of people being able to buy things from bottle shops and policing bottle shops. I mean, children are getting alcohol, 10-year-old children, they're getting it from somewhere. If they're getting it from their parents, well, that is a separate issue, and I think that needs some kind of counselling or something should be addressed to the parents under that circumstance. But if kids are going out with their mates, you know, 14, 15, 16, and they're able to get hold of serious alcohol and do a job on themselves, you can't hold parents responsible for that, you know. What about all the advertising?
Jailing the parents of truants. Primary school principals have backed the Premier's move, but the Federation of Parents and Citizens Association have attacked it, and Tony Vincent has spent 30 years researching education at disadvantage, said it could do more harm than good. It is impossible for me to see how a threat like this is going to enhance the life prospects of a child. Gloria Larman, the chief executive of Shine for Kids, a support group for the children of prisoners, said children with a parent in jail are 5 times more likely than an average child to end up in jail themselves. Are they going to send the Minister for Community Services to jail because he is the legal guardian of many kids that don't go to school? Emma revealed he would strengthen the Education Department powers to allow it to seek court orders to force a parent to enrol their child in school, and if the parents disobeyed, they could face jail.
For me, the question is why they're actually going truant rather than pointing the finger at the parents. I mean, why are children not feeling engaged enough with the curriculum to want to be there? These things need to be asked.
Yeah, well, overcrowded classrooms, there's a host of, things that you can point out about schools, especially boys who are disadvantaged in the education system. I mean, the statistics are screaming that at us every day. It's just another... But, I mean, punishing parents. I mean, parents what who... I mean, parents, if they can't police the fact that their children are not going to school, well, probably both parents have got a job. They're probably working ridiculous hours. Throwing them in jail is not going to help.
No, not at all.
But I guess there's also the parents out there that that do condone it and do go out and get alcohol for their children because they think it's you know, a fun thing to do. And, you know, in some cases, I think, you know, you really have to look at what's happening at home and making sure that you have the right story. And if it is the parents, we'll certainly send them off to counselling. But don't jail them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
A lot of situations. I mean, the definition of a parent. I mean, what are step parents? I mean, all the statistics don't make that much difference between a biological father and a stepfather. I mean, of course, the stepfather wants to be the teenage boy's best mate if he possibly can, because that will make things better for his relationship with the kid's mother. You know, there's lots of factors that can take into account. But if it's a biological father, statistics show that any child is statistically their safest when they are in the presence and custody of their biological father. So,
Andrew Clennell, he's the state political editor at the Sydney Morning Herald, wrote in a comment piece on this, parents in jail for having truant children, Just when you thought it could not get... talk any tougher, the Yemma government has surpassed itself. It is the old tactic from the Carr government, that was the predecessor, the Yemma playbook of diffusing other problems that the government might have by making some sort of law and order announcement to capture the running on the evening television bulletins. Of course, Bob Carr was an absolute expert at that. He was a former journalist himself, and he was always good at making the announcement that would get, and the short 10-second take that would get onto the television news. Absolutely hopeless at answering any tough questions. Get a cheap headline early and it does not matter whether the announcement comes to fruition or not. And, you know, the chances of this actually happening are probably, you know, very remote. But he's managed to capture the news cycle and steer it away from their many other problems, including corruption. We'll be back in a moment and we'll be talking with Malia Blong. She's an expert on boys' education.
Shotgun. It's a nice day to start. start again. It's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to start again. Hey little sister, what have you done? Hey little sister, who's the only one? I've been away for so long,
so long.
I've been away for so long,
so long.
I let you go for so long. It's a nice day to start again. Come on, it's a nice day for a white wedding. It's a nice day to start again. Ow.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air. On the line from the US, we have Malia Blom. And Malia is the director of an organisation called Boys in Schools. Malia, it's a great pleasure to have you on Dad's on the Air this morning.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. Do you want to just outline, first of all, for our listeners, what Boys in Schools does? Tell us a bit about the organisation.
All right. We are part of the Men's Health Network, and we were basically started because these trends surrounding boys in the United States have been mostly overlooked. We know that boys are entering college in lower rates, they're falling behind in school on all sorts of fronts, and they wanted to kind of create an organization that raises awareness of those issues, because there's really just not a lot of information out there in the U.S., not a lot of not really much awareness about the problem in general. So Boys in Schools was created to kind of let people know that this exists and to start working towards solutions and trying to find a way to reach out and help boys.
You have two sons yourself, is that right, Andy and Magnus?
Yes, that's right.
And has that been a big part in you becoming such a passionate advocate for boys' education, the experience of actually raising two boys yourself?
Oh, absolutely. I was actually one of four girls growing up, so boys, completely a different species to me. When I finally had two, it was kind of a revelation and a bit of a trial, I'll admit, at times. And that's when I sort of started to read more and become more aware of the issues surrounding boys, and that's why I got involved.
What are the key issues that you see at the moment in terms of the U.S. education system? If there were sort of the top three areas where you see that boys are disadvantaged or that you could make some changes, what would those be?
Well, I guess I would say that the number one problem, I mean, there's all sorts of symptoms of problems.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that the number one problem is that boys aren't entering college in lower rates. It just keeps slipping and slipping behind girls proportionally, to the point where some colleges feel the need to give boys a sort of boost to get in. So you could say that's, you know, a big a big sign of the issue. But I think a lot of people would agree that, you know, what you're looking at is a series of causes, and that somehow, somewhere, the educational system in America has just begun to fail boys. It's become unfriendly to boys, and is failing to get them ready for school. When you look at the rates of literacy, reading and writing, there are huge gaps between boys and girls that just grow as they go through school. And so I think the biggest problem is that schools have lost track of how to teach boys, and they don't seem particularly interested in figuring it out. In fact, they seem almost unaware that there's a problem.
You'll still hear articles and see articles written and people speaking that there's still some sort of girl crisis in education that still needs addressing, and the thought of actually, you know, bringing in some programs to address boys is somehow strikes people as a strange thing to do.
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting point. There, just a few years ago, the president of Harvard basically got fired for suggesting that maybe more men were interested in science from a sort of innate preference or ability.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference between how boys and girls perform in science is minuscule compared to how the difference between how much girls surpass boys in reading and writing tests in the United States. But the science issue comes up, and there are studies and grants and new organizations founded and all sorts of new initiatives. We have to get girls into the sciences, and that's great. I'm all for getting girls into the sciences, but the contrast is just striking. When you have, you know, a couple points percentage difference, maybe, you know, within the margin of error between boys and girls on math and sciences, and 5, 10, 12 more points difference between boys and girls in reading and writing, you kind of think, what's going on here? It's as though, you know, the problems that boys have are not even worthy of note. Interestingly, a lot of the time when people do recognize the problem, they turn it around. I was reading a piece in Time about the college gap in between boys and girls. The author notes that the girl-boy ratio is just getting bigger and bigger. Colleges have started to favor boys. College admissions officers talk about their concerns, what's going on, why aren't boys going to college? And at the very end of the article, she takes it back to, I wonder how this affects girls. In the face of this mountain of evidence that something is very wrong with the state of boys in education, it still comes back to, how is this affecting girls?
Quoting from that particular article in Time magazine that was called Affirmative Action for Boys, that was written by Nancy Gibbs, mm-hmm. She writes that a gender gap has reopened. If girls were once excluded because they somehow weren't good enough, they are now rejected because they're too good. Or at least they are so good compared with boys that admissions committees at some private colleges have problems managing a balanced freshman class. So Gibbs seems to put the blame for boys' educational difficulties on the boys themselves. Boys are just dumb and girls are just better. Whereas, 20 years ago when we were fixing up the school system so that it taught our daughters well, it was all about the system having the problem, not the girls themselves. Do you see a problem? Is this a typical perspective that somehow it's the problem with the boys themselves rather than the schools?
I do think that there's this existing double standard there. And, you know, the blame for this kind of thing, it always slows down until, you know, I was at an education conference and one of the teachers was telling a joke that, you know, the college people say that if only they'd been taught better in high school, that would have fixed it. And the high school teachers say that it was middle school teachers. The middle school teachers blame the elementary teachers. Elementary teachers blame the preschool teachers. The preschool teachers blame the parents, and the parents blame the boys. they just keep going down the line like that. Actually, I think the teachers blame the mother, and the mother blame the father, and the father blame the boy, but
still, no one's taking responsibility.
Exactly, and it's a lot easier to say, because it's a lot easier to say that there's something innately different about boys, despite the double standard there, than to say, hey, you know, maybe there's something socially wrong here. Maybe something has gone awry culturally that is causing this problem.
Right, and it seems to be, it's a relatively recent problem that I was looking at the graduate statistics for Australian universities over the 80s, 90s and 2000s, and literally the ratio of graduates has gone from 60-40 male to 60-40 female over those three decades. The gender ratio is literally swapped, and it happens to be coincide with the era of feminism and the biggest, I guess, stir up of gender relations that human race has ever seen. So I suspect that that's got something to do with it.
It also coincides with increased family breakdown as well during this period.
Yep, and increased single parent
families.
Families.
Exactly.
Do you think, Malia, that one of the big issues is the fact that a lot of boys are being raised by single mums, and they then possibly go into schools where most of the teachers are female, and the lack of male role models for boys could be a factor?
Oh, I absolutely think that the lack of male role models is a huge factor. I mean, when you look at some of the worst places where the worst gaps exist, it's often in inner cities where there's not a lot of male role models to begin with, not a lot of father presence, and on top of that, everywhere in the United States, at least, women are the vast majority of teachers, especially in younger grades. You don't really start to see any significant proportion of male teachers until you get to almost high school. So there isn't a lot of good positive role models of men out there. And I do think, you know, as you mentioned, the last 30 to 50 years has just seen some massive social changes. And we're still kind of sorting out what the fallout is from that. And yes, I do think that, you know, breakdown of the family, you know, it's a big problem, and there's a lot of different little pieces, you know, to it. But I do think breakdown of the family has had an impact.
And within the classroom, what makes teaching more desirable for boys to engage in and makes them learn better?
Well, that's interesting. There's actually quite a few theories, and, you know, I would probably be remiss if I didn't say, you know, what works for one boy doesn't always work for the other. But I think what I keep hearing is that one of the biggest differences, one of the biggest changes, has been the elimination of competition from the classroom. You know, competition can be a very powerful motivator for boys. And at the other hand, it can be something that in a feminized classroom sort of starts to disappear because of the different styles of learning, the different preferences in learning. And I think that, you know, as competition slowly leaves classrooms, as it's, you know, unfriendly, it makes people feel bad, that kind of thing. I think that's one of the things that has contributed to a more girl-friendly classroom than boy-friendly.
Do you think that single-sex classes or even single-sex schools might be one solution that could be adopted to sort of really tailor education to the needs of both boys and girls?
Oh, absolutely. If I was, you know, head of the Department of Education, that would be one of my biggest things. But they've tried to make more allowances for single-sex programs in the U.S., but it's a legal minefield still at this point in time, and just really something we haven't seen a lot of. But I do think that one of the keys is, especially for boys, can be single-sex classes, single-sex schools, at the very least single-sex programs within schools.
Look, we're running out of time. We've probably only got another minute left. Might just get you to give some contact details for the boys in schools if people are interested in some of your resources, in maybe looking at your website or getting in touch with you. Can you give us your contact details?
Oh, I would love to. You can see the Boys in Schools website on the web at www.boysandschools.com, all written out, BOYSANDSCHOOLS, boysandschools.com. You can see a bunch of facts and data. Also, we have a blog with, you know, recent news on the issues at the website. You can also call us in the U.S. At 202-543-6461. And if you have questions or need information or help, that's where you can reach us.
Fantastic. Malia, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show today. Sorry we've run out of time, but we'd love to get you back on the show in the future and have a bit more of a chat with you.
Oh, that sounds great. I would love to. Thank you.
And don't forget, we'll be back with Dads on the Air at the same time next week. That's 10:30 to 12. You can also listen to this program at www.dadsontheair.net. We'd like to thank our guests, Barbara Kay from the National Post and Malia Blong, an expert in American expert on boys' education. Next week, we should have a really fascinating show. The authors of The Woodcutter's Wife, a very passionate book about step-parenting. And it sounds dull, I guess, but it's making quite a lot of waves, The Woodcutter's Wife, and it sounds like a really interesting book. And also we'll have Helen Hughes. She's an emeritus professor at the Centre for Independent Studies, and she's written a book, Indigenous Education in the Northern Territory, a fascinating book. We'll be back next week.
When Dad's on the air, where here comes we care, we ask.